KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego Art Power, presenting Dream Like Taylor, a live band journey through the enchanted eras of Taylor Swift featuring Cassie B on July 12th at the Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets and the complete summer lineup at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Cross-border sewage has been contaminating the air and water of South Bay communities for years. We know the sewage infrastructure along the border is failing, but what impact is the pollution having on people's health?
So, you know, you have bubbles bursting, waves crashing, everything that sprays over that carries into the air, and the air can travel for miles. So what we don't know is how much of that is getting into our homes.
Then, Southwestern College has faced accusations of racial discrimination in recent years. Has it done enough to address those concerns? Plus, we dive into other stories from this week in the Roundup. That's just ahead on KPBS Roundtable. San Diego's South Bay communities have struggled with the problem of sewage and pollution spilling over from Tijuana, which has contaminated the water and caused beaches to be closed for months on end. But what impacts is this having on people's health and the health of the community overall? Earlier this week, San Diego County Board of Supervisors Chairwoman Nora Vargas called on the Centers for Disease Control and the California Department of Public Health to investigate the effects of cross-border pollution on public health. Also this week, a new report from the Surf Rider Foundation found the waters off Imperial Beach failed to meet state health standards for all of 2023. Tammy Murga covers the South Bay for the San Diego Union-Tribune and has been following the cross-border sewage crisis. Tammy, welcome to Roundtable.
Hi, thank you for having me.
To start, what's causing the cross-border sewage crisis and how long has it been going on?
It's been going on for a very long time. We've had reports that sewage has been leaking over the border into the San Diego region as early as the 1930s. So it's a long time. Now, the cause is really this complicated mesh of multiple issues. You have a really fast-paced growing population in Tijuana, as well as the complicated relationships between the U.S. and Mexico. And then you have years of disrepair and underinvestment in wastewater treatment plants on both sides of the border. So in Baja California, you have the San Antonio de los Buenos plant, and that hasn't been working for a long time. So water that should be treated there goes directly into the ocean, and that reaches our beaches here in San Diego as well as Tijuana. So that's how we see all these beach closures. So it's really been an ongoing, devastating problem that's only worsened over time with these disrepairs.
And it seems like it's gotten more acute really in the last few years in, you know, stretches of beaches closed for a long time, it seems like.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that at first it was really only in the Tijuana River Valley area. It's been moving up more to where people in Coronado, in Chula Vista, even National City have kind of complained about odors and stuff. So we're seeing that it's kind of spreading up even more.
And yeah, let's talk about some of those impacts, right? Let's start with what we know. How bad is the water quality and how is it affecting the air quality?
So we know through the county's sensitive water quality testing that the water is unsafe to swim in, right? To get in, even just contact, it's very unsafe. And a 2023 Scripps study found that bacteria from untreated wastewater in the ocean off of Imperial Beach is becoming airborne. So what that tells us is you don't even have to come into contact with the water. Simply breathing it could potentially make you ill. So that's very concerning.
Definitely, definitely concerning. But there's a lot that we also don't know about this, right? So how do these pathogens transfer from the air or from the ocean into the air and then perhaps spread more broadly? And how could that impact people's health? What do we know or what don't we know about that?
Yeah, and speaking with San Diego researchers, they've kind of told me that sewage bacteria, even toxic chemicals, a lot of them that are even banned in the U.S., they can get trapped in the surf zone. So, you know, you have bubbles bursting, waves crashing, everything that sprays over that carries into the air, and the air can travel for miles. So what we don't know is how much of that is getting into our homes. What are the long-term impacts of that, right? So that's what a lot of the interest is in. We're hearing a lot of testimonies about people getting ill, but, you know, what are those long-term effects is what we all want to know.
And speaking of those symptoms, those complaints that residents have expressed, in communities like Imperial Beach, San Ysidro, the Tijuana River Valley, what symptoms have people been reporting? What have you heard from people who live in those areas?
Yeah, there's been a variety of issues. People complaining about headaches, nausea, even vomiting and diarrhea. So you have a wide range of issues. A lot of people have been mentioning that they're reaching for their inhalers a lot more. Their children are getting asthma, and older adults, their asthma is coming back. What's troubling is that a lot of these testimonies, people are saying that once they leave the Imperial Beach or just South Bay, these impacted communities, as soon as they head up north out of these communities, they feel better. You know, that as soon as they get away from their environment, their breathing is better, their coughing stops, their headaches end. So I think that's very telling.
In your reporting, you had talked to families, especially people with young children. How are residents navigating this, right? I mean, if they call these communities home, you know, one of the things that you would like to depend on as being safe or reliable is the air that you're breathing every single day. So how are they trying to navigate this?
Yeah, it's challenging for a lot of families. I think it's important to remember that this is a community with a lot of low-income families, right? People that live in apartments as well. So especially in the summer when it gets really hot, people are having to make the decision of, do I close my windows because I don't have, you know, AC, but I'll bear through that because I just cannot stand the sewage stench. A lot of families have taken it upon themselves to buy air purifiers, use candles, do anything they can to stop the odors from coming into their homes because they feel that's what's causing, you know, most of their illnesses. A lot of folks have mentioned buying monitors to detect any pathogens inside their home. So they're doing what they can, right? A lot of folks just spend the time weekends with other family members outside of town. Folks that just can't even go to the beach, right? A lot of families say that that's the reason why they moved to Imperial Beach, right? To raise their families close to the water, recreate there, but they can't anymore. So it's case-by-case basis, but a lot of families find it just easier to relocate.
And your reporting notes that many of the beaches in Imperial Beach have been closed for, what is it, 900 consecutive days? Is
right.
that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've done some reporting there, nowhere near as much as you, but some where I've gone down and talked to folks and seen lots of hustle and bustle on the boardwalk, on the in the areas around the beach. But in the water, it'll be almost completely empty or there won't be anyone in there at all. It's sort of a surreal scene. So what does that do to a community whose identity and culture are so closely tied to the ocean, coastal access, and the beach?
Right. And I think it's really interesting because just looking at Imperial Beach, they're known for their surf culture, right? So, I mean, just walked, as you mentioned, walked down the boardwalk, you'll see everyone is either on the pier, maybe sitting on the sand. No one gets in the water. And businesses that are right along Seacoast Drive, they'll tell you that they see less people going in there buying beach towels, right? Boogie boards, et cetera. So that does impact their economies, a lot of the businesses there. So there's that aspect. As I mentioned earlier, young families who want to move to Imperial, who have moved to Imperial Beach to raise their kids by the beach, it's clearly not the case, or not what they imagined, right? And then there's also a lot of nonprofits. You have YMCA, the surf camp right there, that they have to bus their children to Mission Bay because they can't teach them how to surf in their own waters there. So there's multiple communities in South Bay that are impacted. That's Imperial Beach. You have the Tijuana River Valley folks. We have a lot of farmers there, a lot of ranches, horse ranches, right? Their businesses are also impacted. The South Bay is an area that needs more affordable, green, organic food, places to recreate. And so this area is also obviously directly impacted by the sewage crisis. So you see anything from economics to lifestyle changes. People are impacted in many ways.
A fascinating story you did recently was about lifeguards and how this problem is impacting how these people do their jobs, which is hard work. It's life-saving work, and it can be very dangerous work. So what are the impacts on lifeguards? What new precautions have they had to take? And does this create dangerous hurdles potentially for the work that they do?
Yes, their work is changing. I think something that really stuck with me is they're calling themselves land lifeguards. And what that means is they're doing more work on land than they are in water now. They only get in the water if they absolutely have to. So they're spending most of their hours on land advocating, basically. They're telling people, don't get in the water. You know, they're putting signs, warning signs to ensure that folks know the water is quote unquote closed, or the beach is quote unquote closed, right? So I think that that's changing. And even just if you go to Coronado or Imperial Beach, you'll see that they're donning new equipment. Imperial Beach, for example, they have these mobile showers attached to their vehicles. So every time they get in the water, they can decontaminate before even getting back in their vehicle. Things like that. Coronado is planning to buy face shields, dry suits, and they're also thinking about using boats instead of jet skis, all to kind of minimize the contact that they have with water and, again, only get in there if they absolutely need to conduct a rescue. But you can imagine how more challenging that's become for their everyday job, right? It's not something that you see anywhere else in the country, they've mentioned. So they're really working to establish new standards. For example, these new equipment, right? If there's something in the books that can help them navigate their job better, that's something that they're working towards. So it is definitely something that has become a lot more challenging for them, and obviously the public who may be at risk when, you know, we have an emergency. So,
yeah, I mean, it's alarming also because I know recruiting lifeguards can be a challenge, just generally speaking, because it is tough work. It can be dangerous work. And this, I imagine, might make recruiting even harder, right? This added variable to it, this added danger. You had also discussed in your reporting claims that lifeguards may file if they have, you know, potential injuries or concerns that they have had some sort of health effect. In your reporting, did you find that those have increased, or is that still unclear?
I think it's still unclear. I think the cities are still, or at least I could speak on Imperial Beach, they're still trying to, I guess, find out how to best use that strategy or that system. I think a lot of lifeguards have been finding it challenging to identify, you know, what is an exposure, what isn't. If, you know, every day on the job, is it an exposure? How much, you know, does it require me to just get in the water? So I think they themselves are struggling with finding their own standards for that. But we have, at least the Imperial Beach has reported, Imperial Beach Lifeguard Department has reported, you know, dozens of those claims filed. And I think, again, it comes down to having something in the books to really find out what is and isn't an exposure.
We've been talking a lot about the impacts on the U.S. side of the border. How has this problem impacted life and recreation south of the border in Tijuana and elsewhere?
I think it is important to remember that they're obviously two separate communities. The culture is very different, but they're impacted by the same problem and they share the same ocean. So you'd be surprised to see there are actually a lot of similarities. There are a lot of people who know not to get in the water. The sentiment is very similar to what people feel like it here in South Bay. So I think there's a lot of that. People smell the sewage stench, maybe even worse than they do here, right? And I think that's there's a lot of similarities in that. But also, there are a lot of cultural differences. You see, for example, in spring break, if you could just get a drone maybe and look at, you know, at the same time what beaches look like in Imperial Beach and Tijuana on spring break, you'd see they're very different. There are a lot more children swimming in the water in Tijuana as opposed to Imperial Beach. And this was something that we covered recently in a story. So in speaking to a lot of folks in Imperial Beach and Tijuana, they mentioned, you know, in Tijuana, for example, that's kind of all the that's the only beach that they have, right? Here in San Diego, we can get in our car, drive up maybe a few more miles, and we're North County now, right? And we have more beaches that we can feel safer to get in. Whereas in Tijuana, that's about it. If you go down more south, there are more rocky beaches. So even just geographical differences, they don't have that same sandy, toes in sand, right, scene. So that's also very different.
What have local public health officials done so far to monitor this, you know, the potential health issues. And what have they found?
A lot of the county's response has been mostly surveillance. They've surveilled hospital data, school absenteeism data, and data from urgent cares and also from air pollution control districts, collection of air in the area. But they've concluded that there's no increases in reportable diseases. So it's, I guess, for folks who are experiencing a lot of these symptoms that might be kind of, you know, they question, like, what more can we do if this is how we feel, but there's no increases and, you know, what should there be more investigations? And I think that's what we're starting to see a lot more now.
Yeah, because I wonder what might the shortcomings or limitations be of the surveillance and data collection that the county is doing? Because there is this mismatch, as you said. The county is not finding a significant increase, but we're hearing more and more from people that, hey, we're experiencing these symptoms. So where might the disconnect be?
I think there's actually a lot of several factors, a lot of gaps. One of them being not a lot of people are getting tested. So only the most severe cases end up in the hospital. For, let's just take diarrhea, for example, right? Very uncomfortable. So to get tested per CDC guidelines, if you want to get tested for that, you really need to present other symptoms like fever. You have to have this problem for a long time and also even present blood in your stool. So these will, again, most severe cases. And a lot of people don't have those other symptoms. So they don't always go to the hospital. They tend to just stay at home. They also can't get a doctor's appointment very soon. And a lot of people also, they get their care in Tijuana as well, right? So there are a lot of gaps in that as well. Also, if people aren't getting tested, those are cases that could be missed, right? And so not everything is required to get reported to the public health system. As we see, there are a lot of gaps here in the testing. And I think a lot of San Diego researchers are thinking we need a different approach, something non-traditional to be able to find out if there are links, and if so, what are those long-term effects?
Yeah, and you've reported on some of these new research efforts to assess potentially hazardous air quality and the impacts on people's health. What are researchers trying to determine, and what are they doing to gather this data?
Yeah, as I mentioned, they really want to understand if there are any links between the symptoms that people are feeling and the contaminants in the water and the air, even the soil. I mean, not just sewage, but also toxic chemicals that are banned in the U.S. So if there are those links, then how does that affect people's health long-term and also people who are the most vulnerable, right? We have seniors, we have children. So those are some of the questions they want to answer. And there's a new task force that just launched with San Diego and researchers and medical professionals. And they're going to launch a survey and kind of ask all of South County, what are you feeling, right? What are the symptoms that you've experienced? Have you been exposed recently? If so, when and how? So all these questions hopefully get a better picture of what's going on, and then as well as launch, use some low-tech equipment. For example, SDSU and UCSD researchers mentioned that they'll use these wristbands that can kind of help collect dust or anything else in the environment to kind of tell you, okay, if I'm at home, what is being gathered in my home, right? And is that making me ill? Things like that. They're also talking about using a vehicle, driving it around all of South County to see what air is in the environment, and is that making people ill? So I think that those are hopefully some mechanisms that will help us get a better picture of what is happening in the South Bay.
And to wrap up, are you optimistic about these efforts? Do you think that we're heading in the right direction, or there might be some answers for people who are experiencing these issues?
Absolutely. I do actually have a lot of hope that we are heading in the right direction. For example, Congress has been approving a lot of funding for the International Boundary and Water Commission that is responsible for managing the wastewater plant here in San Diego. And, you know, if we can get to the source, right, fixing it and expanding that, then that's going to bring a lot of relief to the communities. And as well as all of this interest in finding out answers for the public's health, really doing that research, I think that's definitely something that we need. And I think we have a lot of really great experts here in San Diego that are taking this work on. So I think we're heading in the right direction.
Tammy Murga covers the South Bay for the Union Tribune. Tammy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
When Roundtable returns, Southwestern College has been grappling with accusations of racial discrimination in recent years.
The exact words were a palpable climate of anti-blackness. And I read the report, and honestly, I can't even bring myself to share the specific incidents because they were so disturbing to me.
That's next on Roundtable.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, inviting you to experience the science of story. 6 days of programming celebrating how and why we tell the stories that move us from July 23rd through the 28th at UC San Diego. Events include Clarion Writers Masterclass, A Tale of Two Sulus, An Evening with George Takei and John Cho, Star Trek in Concert with the San Diego Symphony, and more. For information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Two former professors from South Bay's Southwestern College are suing the school, alleging retaliation after they reported racial discrimination. But it's not the first time concerns of racism have surfaced about the college. In 2018, a USC assessment called out the school's quote-unquote climate of anti-blackness. In a two-part story, KPBS's racial justice and social equity reporter Katie Heisen delved into how the school has wrestled with racial discrimination in recent years. Katie, thanks for coming on Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
To start, let's go back to 2018 and what the University of Southern California study found about Southwestern College. Tell us about it.
So, yes, the exact words were a palpable climate of anti-blackness. And I read the report, and honestly, I can't even bring myself to share the specific incidents because they were so disturbing to me. But there is one line in the report that I think really sums it up. They said, over the past 11 years, African-American students, faculty, and staff have shared with us especially horrendous examples of their encounters with racism on campuses. Unfortunately, we have grown accustomed to this. But honestly, the stories we heard from classified employees at Southwestern were the worst of any place we have been.
I mean, that's not mincing words at all. Mm-hmm. That's remarkable. I mean, what did that say to you, especially as you were working on this story and putting into context some of the newer developments that we'll get to?
It was odd for me to see how far back these kinds of allegations of racism stretched back. I'm new to San Diego. I just moved here a year ago and came to report on the racial justice and social equity beat. And so I wasn't here when that report came out. And this was all new to me. And so I think it did make me feel like the lawsuit was definitely worth looking at closer, knowing that there had been a history of these kind of findings at the college before.
Right. So we have the report in 2018 with some very stark, unsettling findings. Now two professors are suing Southwestern College. What are they alleging?
Before we jump in, just want to extra stress that, you know, this is a pending legal matter. We haven't heard from all sides. So everything we're about to talk about are still allegations at this point. So these two professors worked in the dental hygiene program, and they're saying that over the years, they witnessed racist remarks themselves, but also they had students coming to them, breaking down in tears in their office over racist experiences they were having at the hands of professors and administrators. And so that these students were scared to report it themselves. So these two professors said, we'll bring a Title IX complaint on your behalf. In that Title IX complaint, which is what you file at a school when you see a protected class being discriminated against, that they're actually required to report that, they voiced fear in that complaint that they would be retaliated against. This lawsuit says that's exactly what happened next. So that complaint was filed, and then their lawyer says that the school started making up violations and changing their hours. They took one professor off a class she had taught for over a decade, ultimately put them on administrative leave. And all this building up of stresses, according to the lawsuit, caused these professors to quit.
You did visit the college during your reporting for this two-part series, and you spoke to students. What did they tell you?
So I spoke with two kind of groups of students. One was alumni of this dental hygiene program, and they all shared stories that were similar to what was in the Title IX complaint, is similar to what was in the lawsuit, just very vivid stories of racial discrimination. I also spoke with students not in the dental hygiene program. I was curious what the campus was like, particularly for Black students today, because of that 2018 report. So I sat down with members of an African-American geared learning community they have. The stories they shared were more kind of the stories, almost a universal experience of what it's like to be a minority in a space. But aside from those very common experiences, said that they felt supported by the school. So I think that that just goes back to, like, no community is a monolith, right? Not all Black students at Southwestern are going to have the same experience. And I think it also speaks to this dental hygiene program being a particular point of concern.
And what did you make of these stories from students? You know, what stood out to you?
What stood out to me is how many years the stories I was hearing spanned. After this story went out, after I published, I heard from even more alumni stretching even more years back, sharing similar stories. And the other thing that stood out to me was how much fear there still was. Like, these are alumni. They've earned their degree. They're professionals. Some of them are very well established in their careers now. And there was so much nerves around this. And even symptoms of trauma type symptoms of saying, like, this time in my life has become a blur. I've really tried to shove this down. But there are specific things that happened to them that are in very vivid detail still. So just how much this affected them, I think, stood out. And how, you know, these incidents that might seem minor when taken individually can really build up to a crushing experience for a student.
Yeah. And can you give an example of, you know, an experience that one or some of these students may have had and help illustrate how that can have such a lasting and cumulative impact on these students?
Mm-hmm. The stories I heard ranged from things like saying, if you see a Black man working on the air conditioner, don't be afraid. That's the dean's assistant. Ranging from remarks like that to actions like an immigrant student's work being copied by a non-immigrant student and the non-immigrant student receiving much higher scores. So it really ranged the gamut from, like, these remarks that, and I heard this from a lot of students, that they were these kind of remarks that would cause them to question themselves because it was just subtle enough where they're thinking, did I hear that right? Is that in my head? Is that what she meant to say? All the way to more concrete things like grades.
Your story highlights and drills down into the power imbalances at play here. Tell me about that.
That also really struck me about this story is that these aren't comments that are like one-on-one, easy to brush off like you're in the schoolyard or something. These are whole structures that enable these kind of things to continue. So this is not just an individual professor, but these allegations are saying that it's also the department head over her and then the people who supervise the department head, peers who would witness this but not come forward. There's a whole structure here. And these students, I think part of why the fear was so intense for them is that this really is their future on the line. Students in South Bay, for a lot of them, Southwestern College is the only real feasible option for their associate's degree. They don't all have the ability to leave home. A lot of them rely on public transit. So this is their future. and their degree is on the line. And one student I spoke with, Laureen Azen, spoke to that really beautifully. I think we have a clip of that.
You know, you're vulnerable. This is, you know, your livelihood. You've gone through so many years of school. You kind of just don't know what you're at the mercy of these people. You know, you can't do much. You can't say what you want to say. You can't react how you want to react. So, I mean, I was just stunned.
And that really highlights the power imbalances that you're describing mm-hmm. and the impacts that it's having on these students and lasting, you know, even beyond that into when they're alumni and these experiences sticking with them. You also spoke with the college's president and executive officer of equity and engagement. What did they have to say about how the college has tried to address these issues over the last 6 years?
So they couldn't speak to anything in the lawsuit, but they did want to talk to me about the efforts they've made since that 2018 report. The president, he came in 2 years after that report. And one thing that stood out to him right away was that the transfer rates for Black male students was, he said he would bet that it was some of the lowest in the state. One of the things he's tried to do is expand how many four-year colleges and universities could offer their programs on Southwestern's campus to make them more accessible for these students. That seems to be successful so far. They also hired the chief equity officer right after that report came out. Numbers are too soon to tell yet for this year, but the president does say that they're seeing an indication that Black student enrollment might be up. And they say they see more diversity in their hiring pools. I will note that when I checked the data for African American faculty and administrators in particular, that is trending down. But they tell me overall diversity is increasing.
What challenges did you encounter trying to report this story?
I think every reporter can relate to this, but particularly when there's a pending legal matter. You know, I had only one side willing to talk about the lawsuit. That makes it really hard. If I can't hear not just from the school, but I would have loved to hear from the professors named in the Title IX complaint. They both declined to comment, didn't want to do an interview. And then also, you know, most of these students are scared to speak. And so I had anonymous letters in the Title IX complaint. I had a lot of student experiences, but they were not, didn't have names attached. So that was another challenge of finding students and alumni who were willing to have the courage to talk, even though it's a really hard thing to come forward against people who held a position of power over you, even when that's over.
Absolutely. I mean, back to that issue of power imbalances and how mm-hmm. it has a lasting effect. How does your experience reporting this story reflect some of the challenges more broadly with reporting on the race and equity beat?
I love this question. And my partner, who I come home to every day, can testify to these frustrations after most days of reporting. Racial justice issues have always been underdocumented, and that's part of the reason that they take so long to come to light oftentimes. By nature, there are less written accounts of them, and the power imbalances keep people from speaking. And then think of the sources we normally look to. News reports. Newsrooms have been predominantly white since the beginning of journalism. Most newsrooms have. Police reports. They used to be taken as gospel, right? Like as primary source facts. You can count on this. Well, now we know that a lot of times there are differing narratives than the police report, and that those are being authored by people with you know, skin in the game. Even death certificates, I have learned on this beat, cannot be always be trusted as fact. And so when you think about the structures normally in charge of documenting and reporting are often biased themselves. And so there will always be a harder fight, I think, on a racial justice beat to get to the level of documentation and corroboration journalists normally want to get a story out. We have to push because, you know, what are we going to throw up our hands and say, well, I guess we just won't tell these stories because it's not it's not as neatly laid out for us, you know? It requires a lot of pushing. I don't know if that answered your question.
It did. It absolutely did. And we appreciate all of your digging into this and the hard fight that you put up to, you know, get to the facts and get the story out there for us to have a deeper understanding of these issues. So thank you.
Thank you.
Katie Heisen is KPBS's racial justice and social equity reporter. Katie, thanks for joining Roundtable.
Thanks, Scott.
When we come back, we catch up on some other stories we've been following this week on the Roundup. That's coming up after the break.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, inviting you to experience the science of story. 6 days of programming celebrating how and why we tell the stories that move us from July 23rd through the 28th at UC San Diego. Events include Clarion Writers Masterclass, A Tale of Two Sulus, An Evening with George Takei and John Cho, Star Trek in Concert with the San Diego Symphony, and more. For information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome back to Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. It's time now for our weekly roundup of stories we've been following. Joining me is Andrew Bracken. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Scott.
All right, start us off. What have you been following this week?
I got a pair of stories related to the Imperial Valley. The first of which comes from CalMatters' Alejandro Lasso, and he had a really interesting article into the Imperial Valley's lack of EV infrastructure. They only have 4 of those fast-charging public chargers, and they have a really low rate of EV adoption. And what's interesting about it is that that region is really important to green energy in California, and it's just kind of an interesting kind of look into how they rank dead last in EV car ownership among California counties with populations over 100,000. And I just thought it was really interesting. It's also a community that struggles with unhealthy air and some environmental impacts where, you know, having more green energy, green vehicles, electric vehicles would have really potential benefits to the communities there. You know, it also just points another aspect of some of the challenges of these sort of like statewide changes that California goes through, being how large California is and how different some counties are from others. That obviously the nature of Imperial County is much more rural, much more spread out compared to, you know, San Diego County where we are.
What's the other Imperial Valley story that you have for us?
It's a related story, and it comes from KPBS's Corey Suzuki, and he's doing a 2-part series on the potential of the lithium industry in the Imperial Valley and some of the conflicted feelings there. Like I said, kind of tied to this green energy potential future, but how, you know, the communities there have been sort of burnt by past promises of this kind of green future.
In addition to Corey being a great reporter, he's an excellent photographer. So the story itself is fascinating, but the photography is also incredible. And it captures both at the ground level, and he went up in a plane and actually caught photos of, some of these green energy efforts. I think one was geothermal. He caught some photos of plants there and then also some solar photos. So it puts into perspective, what this effort looked like to try to adopt green energy. I just thought it was excellent reporting and really illustrated why there might be some hesitation in this
right.
community.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Having that visual from above that he got really kind of puts into perspective some of the challenges there too, because obviously it's that region, it's like over 4,000 square miles or something of land. So there's a lot to take in there. But again, it's just it calls out to me as just some of the inequities with these different counties, you know, where we live in an area where it's really common to see Teslas all over the place, Tesla charging stations, whatever. And you go to Imperial County. I mean, in the CalMatters piece, Alejandro, he talked to an electric vehicle owner named Greg Gelman, and it said he's one of only about 1,200 Imperial County residents who own an electric car, and kind of just talks to him about how it's not super easy for him to get around just with an EV.
Yeah, I believe it. Have you seen any Cybertrucks zipping around our streets?
Oh, multiple.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I got to say, they're goofy looking, but I'm not going to dive into that topic. I'm going to instead catch us up on, you talked about the Imperial Valley. I'm going to catch us up on some things going on from Sacramento. So the state announced that they're going to do an audit of its telework policies as state workers have been, you know, working from home, some hybrid for years now. And of course, as many people know and have experienced themselves, this came out of the pandemic. And this struck me for a couple reasons. One is that, you know, Governor Newsom is pushing for this audit in part because he's pushing to see people back into the office at least a few days a week. And, you know, just rewind the tape a few years ago, and there was this imperative to get people to work from home. And it wasn't a small thing. It wasn't just, hey, work from home for a few days. This went on for years for good reason, right? Because there was the mounting danger posed by the COVID pandemic. But there is a certain whiplash that comes from to have a traditional experience of working in the office, then going to work from home, and now having to come back. To me, it's just fascinating to see how society has had to wrestle and rebound and resettle. And working from home versus working in the office has been an interesting experiment in all of this.
And you're right. And I mean, it reminds me of a lot of aspects of life before the pandemic and since. And I think for a lot of them, what we found is you don't just go back to the way it was, and then that there's this period of change and you're trying to figure out what you're comfortable with. And it's something that, yeah, I think we've talked about it on Roundtable. We've talked about it on Midday Edition. You know, over the last year or two, these kinds of questions that are still not resolved. I think a lot of workplaces, a lot of industries that have been able to have kind of been wrestling with this return to office. I think some industries, it's like they kind of had to and they're back. One thing that I hear from certain people in various industries is one piece of it over the pandemic that may have impacted, you may have seen impacts for younger workers, because I think it may kind of get in the way of some of the mentorship and sort of like when you're learning a new career, when you're learning on the job, really that side-by-side relationship. So a lot of younger workers, I think they found, didn't have that same opportunity to develop, you know, as maybe being in office full time. But it is, right, it's interesting that this is continuing into, you know, well into 2024.
Yeah. And it also has impacts beyond the workplace itself. I mean, many downtowns, and downtown Sacramento is one of them. I used to live in Sacramento for 4 or 5 years before coming down here to San Diego. And it was in the heart of the pandemic that I was there. Downtown Sacramento took a real hit, you know, from that work crowd, especially state employees, not going out to lunch, not going out afterwards for happy hour or dinners. That really did have an impact on the economy there. So part of this push certainly is largely, right, the workplace concerns, but there are impacts beyond that too. Another story that caught my eye coming out of Sacramento, there's a new law that's set to take effect in July, and it effectively bans these surcharges at restaurants where, you know, if you're looking at a menu, you see the price on the right. But if you look down, there might be fine print at the bottom that says, hey, we're going to tack on an extra percentage to cover maybe any variety of things. These surcharges, some customers have expressed complaints about them. The state has decided to effectively ban them, sort of lumping them under the junk fee banner. Have you seen these fees before? Have you experienced them? What are your thoughts?
I frankly didn't really notice it too much just in my day-to-day life. I don't eat out at restaurants all the time, but I have seen it from time to time for sure. But I guess one question I have, you know, just as someone in a restaurant is like where that money goes and exactly how it gets applied to whatever fee it's for. And like, but Scott, I think you briefly worked at a restaurant or a bar somewhere in San Diego recently. And did you notice those fees?
Yeah. When I transitioned from my previous station in Sacramento down to here, I had a gap. And so I went back to my roots bartending. And the restaurant did have one of these surcharges. And a lot of customers, speaking to what you just said, didn't notice it. I would be surprised if they even registered it on the bill. But some people saw it and they raised questions and said, hey, what is this? Is this a tip? What is it? Does it go to you, the employee? And some people raised enough of a concern or a stink that the manager would take it off. So I know some customers have expressed frustration about this, but restaurant owners have made clear that, you know, it's a thin margin business. And so if without these surcharges, the cost of items on the menu is likely to go up as a result. And it may be a small amount, but it will go up to make up for the fact that they had these surcharges.
You're right. And I guess that's what, so it would just kind of show up in a different way. And then at that point, is it just the restaurants would be concerned that restaurant goers would just react to a hamburger being $2 more or just the price of food? But it's still ultimately going to be the same price, right?
I think it would shake out to be the same price, but it's a question of, will that sticker shock of a $16 burger versus $14 affect them? All right, moving on. What else you got for us?
This is something our technical producer, Brandon Truff, actually sent me this. Dave & Buster's, it's a big, you know, arcade restaurant and bar. There's one in Mission Valley. They're looking into allowing betting on their arcade games. And I think you and I have spoke a little bit about this, just how gambling is much more pervasive, I feel like, in our culture. There's like a sports gambling has really taken off. It's not legal in California, but in many states it is. So you just see it a lot in sports today. And I thought this was just sort of like another normalization of gambling in a way that we didn't have, you know, 5-10 years ago. So I don't think it's, you know, it's not up and running yet, but I guess the idea is, you know, you and I could play some air hockey and wager a few bucks on it.
I'll take you up on that. I'll meet you at the Papa Shot and we can have an over-under, see who wins.
Well, those are my two games, so I like it. Let's do it.
All right. Well, Andrew Bracken, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Scott.
That's our show for today. You can listen to KPBS Roundtable anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. Roundtable's technical producer is Brandon Truffa. This show was produced by Andrew Bracken. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. And I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego Art Power, presenting the Cream of Clapton Band, 24 Nights Revisited, a nostalgia concert featuring special guest Nathan East and Greg Bissonette, July 13th at the Epstein Family Amphitheater. Tickets and the complete summer lineup at artpower.ucsd.edu.